We're talking about processing trauma through exercise in a Milwaukee pilot program to empower women through movement. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Trauma-informed martial arts programs are on the rise, and they offer survivors more of a sense of power and control. Do you practice martial arts? Do you powerlift or appreciate kickboxing classes? How have these programs changed the way you think about your body? Do you release emotionally when you do high-intensity interval training? Join in 800-642-1234. Amber Tucker is an assistant professor of sociology at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee, where she is part of the Restorative Justice in Movement research team, and she practices and teaches jiu-jitsu. Amber, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Hi, thank you for having me on.
Good morning. So introduce us to the program Restorative Justice in Movement.
Restorative Justice in Movement is a pilot program and also a funded research project by Marquette University. We're funded by the Institute for Women's Leadership and the President's Challenge for Racial Justice and Equity Response. It is a collaboration of researchers between Cardinal Stritch's, where I am, and Marquette University. And it is a program where we run clinics, introductory clinics to jiu-jitsu, rock climbing, and powerlifting. Mm. And these are just all different ways of thinking about, we don't necessarily refer to it as exercise, just movement modalities. And so just a way to offer different ways of thinking about movement and how body movement, the connection between the mind and body, specifically related to like movement exercise, can help restore or help people process trauma.
When I think about martial arts or powerlifting or rock climbing, you have to trust and you have to get comfortable with movement in your body. Do you think that that's what sets this apart?
Yes. There are so many different benefits. There's emerging research on the benefit of martial arts. I know that I'm connected with a woman in New Zealand, and she's working with like 20 people around the world, and they're working on building trauma-informed martial arts programs. But there has been some newer research that looks at the benefits of jiu-jitsu specifically, and they've been working with combat veterans with PTSD. And so the minimal research that's out has shown that there has been some reported improvements in overall mental health with jiu-jitsu. So specifically with jiu-jitsu, the other martial arts programs absolutely offer the same benefit, because the idea is restoring the connection between the mind and body that is often lost in the experience of trauma. You know, one of the common reported experiences or description of what it's like after the experience of trauma is this loss of sense of self or sense of control over the body, because during the experience of trauma, you know, that's one of the disempowering aspects, is that you lose a sense of control over that moment and over yourself. I personally have experienced multiple forms of trauma, and I just anecdotally can speak to that experience. So that's how I would describe it. After some incidents, I was angry with myself because I didn't respond in the way that I wanted to respond. Instead, I responded automatically, which often happens during trauma. Our responses to high stress or crises or traumatic incidences are automatic. And so for me, my automatic response was freeze. And I was very upset after a couple of trauma incidents with myself, because that's not the response I wanted to have. And through practicing martial arts, I was able to restore that sense of control over my body. And in fact, reprogram, it's the fight, flight, or freeze response that's automatically wired into our brain for survival. And I was able to rewire that response, so that now my trauma response is fight and not freeze.
It sounds like you also gained confidence and assertiveness, and suddenly or over time you knew what your body was capable of doing.
Yes, absolutely. So jiu-jitsu, it's a sport. It's practiced as a combat sport. And so we think about sports. I think one of the things that may deter people from participating in it is the idea of athleticism and strength. And what I learned through jujitsu is that it is an intellectual sport. It's mat chess. Like, you have to, you know, anticipate the responses and moves ahead of time when you're practicing or sparring with another person. And so that ability to be able to, you know, think in a high stress situation. When we're in class and we're sparring, we put ourselves in high stress situations every day. And so over time, you learn to slow down and actually think rather than responding out of fear or a loss of a sense of control or safety. So for jujitsu specifically, that has helped me. And the confidence that I received from it was because I was able to trust my body again. I was able to trust my body that it would do what my mind wanted my body to do. You know, sometimes after trauma, the disconnect between your mind and your body, your mind thinks one way, but your body responds the other way. Well, it helps to restore that connection because your mind and your body have to work together in order for you to have a great experience in training jujitsu.
We're talking with Amber Tucker, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee, part of the Restorative Justice in Movement research team that we're learning about. You can join in. What do you want to know about how these movements can affect trauma and mental health and that recovery? How has exercising helped you get through difficult times in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. Amber, how are participants responding to these clinics? What have they told you?
So we do, my research team consists of Dr. Noelle Brigden from Marquette, and Dr. Heather Havlicka from Marquette, and then Dr. Jennifer Oldendorf from Marquette, and also Madeline Wright, who assists us on our research project. So we do participatory action research. So we're actually in there in the clinics with the participants, participating with them. And so with that upfront and close observations, some of the impactful comments or feedback that I received from the women, I know, for example, we were doing a powerlifting clinic. And the first cycle that we ran this summer, we did an intergenerational project. So we were working with women and their children. Hmm. And there was a mother and a daughter and a teen daughter, and in the powerlifting clinic, we were doing deadlifts. And so when it was the daughter's turn, everyone, and especially the mother, she was, you know, cheerleading and encouraging. It's just like, you can do this, you can do this. And then so when she did one repetition of a deadlift, she was so excited and she clapped. And then when it was her turn to do it, she was hesitant. And she was like, oh, I don't know if I could do this. And so we tried to offer the same, including her daughter, was the same encouragement and support that she was providing for the other women and for her daughter. And I thought that was really interesting that when it came to her, that she was more hesitant to go do the repetition. Like, there was almost not a sense of confidence or belief in herself that she could do it. And so with some gentle kind of goading, she did it. And she did it, and it was beautiful. And we all just stopped and clapped and cheered. And she looked at herself, and there was a mirror. She looked at herself, and she said, I did it. I did it. And that was just so impactful. That was one of the greatest takeaways for me, was restoring that belief back into yourself. And so when we talk about our research, one of the researchers mentioned, and this comes out in trauma studies, especially using like things like exercise and movement, is again that mind and body connection. And then also for women in particular, you know, when we think about sports, again, like, we have this very masculine perspective that sports is all about strength and physicality, but like reframing the way that we think about strength and who's considered to be strong. What I've learned from Dr. Noelle Brigden, who's a powerlifter, and she also does trauma-informed powerlifting. And the ideas about what kinds of bodies do we consider to be strong. And in the powerlifting world, like, you know, some of the strongest women in the world don't look like our typical conceptions of what strength is. That is very muscular, you know, very muscular physiques. But these are some of the strongest women in the world who are winning powerlifting competitions at a global level. And so it completely reframes our idea about what is strength. And jujitsu is exactly that, because it's not really based on strength. It's focused on technique. Strength does help. But for women, it's what I've noticed is a little bit of a different experience when they start jujitsu, and including myself, because you do have that conception that strength means physicality and muscularity. But when we come to jujitsu and you look at some of the top competitors in the world, especially amongst the women, they're very small. Their physiques are very small.
And we're going to get into talking about your journey with jujitsu. Sociologist Amber Tucker combines her mixed martial arts background to empower women. Are you living with trauma? Do you feel comfortable going to a gym? Are there exercise skills you wish you had? What questions do you have about transforming painful emotions into confidence, into assertiveness? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Amber Tucker here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the Restorative Justice in Movement program on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Jiu-jitsu, as we've been learning, is much more than just combative martial arts. It's being used to help women in their recovery from trauma. Have you learned martial arts and rediscovered something inside of you? Did learning jiu-jitsu make you less afraid of something you carry with you in your life? 800-642-1234. Cardinal Stritch University sociologist Amber Tucker is a mixed martial artist, and with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on a caller now. Jean is joining us from Glenflora. Jean, hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. What is your story?
Well, I'm 70 years old, and I have starting to have some problems with arthritis. Well, actually, I've had them for quite a few years, but they were minor. But I've had quite a few minor accidents along the way, wear and tear on the body, and I can't lift heavy weights anymore, or it's hard to practice explosive martial arts training. But I wanted to mention Tai Chi as an option for older people with arthritis, particularly Sun Tai Chi. Tai Chi originated as a martial art many centuries ago in China, and all the concentration skills, all the balance skills, all the training skills are employed there. It can be either individual or group. I practice in both, it's just very helpful for mental strength and for balance. And also, the training for strength is isometric. It's very gentle, but it's really nice for older people who may have some physical problems that limit their ability to really do explosive types of martial arts.
Yes, Jean, thank you so much for bringing Tai Chi into the conversation. Amber, Jean is saying it's for concentration and mental strength. What do you hear about Tai Chi?
Absolutely. I practiced it for a little while in my early days before I really got involved into other forms of martial arts, and I absolutely agree. Like I said, there's just been some newer research on that specifically focused on jiu-jitsu, but I mentioned the other martial arts as well, and I think it's the idea between the mind and body connection and thinking about strength differently and what that means for different bodies and different people. Notions of strength don't all have the same universal meaning. They mean something differently. And so absolutely, it's that trauma experience that disconnects your mind from your body, where your body does one thing, but your mind does the other. And so any form of mindfulness practice like meditation or martial arts, I think, is really helpful in restoring that connection.
Let's bring on Emily now in Madison. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I listen to this every morning. It's really exciting.
Oh, thank you, Emily. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so I'm really interested to hear how I can help my mom get movement into her life. I know she deals with trauma, but it's not like disclosed about what. So she's so disconnected from her body, and I want to support her. And it's such a touchy topic for us, exercise.
Emily, thank you so much. Amber, what would you suggest?
And it doesn't necessarily have to be movement exercises. So I also practice mindfulness. I do meditation and I do yoga. And there's research, a lot more research around that, about mindfulness practices like meditation and yoga that also helps in trauma recovery. So that's one way to approach it. If exercise or movement forms seem like that's not the right thing for right now. That kind of stuff. And then also, you know, therapy. But one of the things I can say in working with trauma survivors and as a survivor of trauma is that, you know, people sometimes and not always will come to tell their stories or disclose. And sometimes people just live with it. And so, you know, I think that that's, you bring up something really interesting. How do the people who are have relationships with people who are trauma survivors, how can we support those people in supporting the people in their lives that experience trauma? So that is a really, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because it sounds like there is something that we have to think about people who are supporting those people, relationships, you know, children or, you know, siblings or just family members. And how can we support people in that kind of way? What kind of resources can we give them to help them if they're not even at the point where, you know, the acknowledgement of trauma is possible?
It sounds too that your intergenerational clinics might help inform that as well as you see those interactions between mothers and daughters.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And I'm not sure of any other types of programs that would include the intergenerational work, but we specifically focus on intergenerational work because, you know, trauma is not just held within one person in the family. And it passes down through generations. It impacts the way that we women, and specifically while we work with mothers, it impacts the way that you mother. It impacted the way that I mother. But I was personally at a place where I was able to, it took me a long time, you know, it took me 30 plus years to even acknowledge the fact that I was dealing and coping with trauma before I started to do something about it. So just the ability to be able to acknowledge it, I think is an important step. And that's also a source of strength too. And so people will come into their own when they're able to share that. But, you know, you can offer other alternatives to exercise and movement like meditation or yoga. Yoga is a very gentle way to still be able to do some work on the body and also kind of work through those things like reestablishing the mind-body connection. So maybe you can offer up some trauma. You can go, you know, or offer up yoga. You can go to YouTube and there are some great people during the pandemic. I taught myself yoga on YouTube and now I go to actual yoga classes. So maybe that could be an option.
We're talking with Amber Tucker, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee, as we look closer at the Restorative Justice and Movement program. Amber, how did jiu-jitsu come into your life? Could you tell us the story?
Absolutely. I've always been into fitness, and I've kind of trained myself, you know, over time, just going to the gym. And I was looking for a new way to exercise or to move. And the gym that I'm at now is a mixed martial arts academy, but they had a fitness program for women, and they would have the fighters teach it. And the classes ended, and the owner suggested that we move over to the traditional classes. And I looked over at those classes and I saw the close body contact. And I was like, I don't think I could do it. And later I ended up doing it. And I got a better workout out of training in the classes than taking the actual fitness class. And then after a couple years, I just started with striking, with kickboxing. And I would see the people doing jiu-jitsu. It's ground combat. There are people on the ground on top of each other. It's co-ed. And that, you know, kind of freaked me out a little bit. And, you know, someone had said to me, you should think about jiu-jitsu. You can probably defend yourself standing up, but what happens if you go to the ground? And more than likely, you know, with small people or women, that's sometimes where the fight happens, is on the ground. And so jiu-jitsu is so empowering. I teach a women's only jiu-jitsu program. And whenever new women join the gym, I tell them, you know, of course, all the martial arts offer the same kind of benefits in terms of confidence and self-awareness and sense of self-safety. But what's so powerful about the jiu-jitsu is we fight on our backs. So the fight isn't over when we're on our backs. You know, we can do, you know, different techniques that can choke you, put you to sleep, that can break your limbs on your back. And so it's so empowering to see some of the women and even the smaller children. I teach a class on Friday nights where the children from the jiu-jitsu class come over. And I have to warn the adults that these 7 and 8 year olds are more, they're more dangerous than the other adults. And it's so interesting to see like some of the new people that come in and they don't take me seriously. And the next thing I know, they're complaining about one of the kids. And I was like, but But that's what jujitsu does. It's really for all body types and all levels. I compete too. I'm a competitor. And with something super powerful, I was at a tournament this summer and we had people competing in these highly ranked, like international, national tournaments who had complete losses of vision. Mm. They're blind competitors. And they still were, you know, and they were at the competition level. So it's a very intense level. And so that really reaffirms my belief and faith in the power of martial arts being adaptable too. You know, and again, that our research is focusing on that idea of like what bodies, what is our notion of like what's a healthy body, what's a strong body. And it's not the stuff that we see on TV and in magazines.
Amber Tucker is an assistant professor of sociology at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee, part of the Restorative Justice in Movement research team. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Inflation is hitting people across the country hard, with costs soaring for things like groceries and gas, electricity. In closely divided Wisconsin, it's top of mind for many voters who are getting ready to cast their ballots Tuesday. Bridget Bowden reports.
Carol Henning and her husband recently retired and moved back to Wisconsin to be close to their daughter in Waukesha.
And so we are now those people who are living on a fixed income.
While she says they aren't in any financial danger right now, they have made adjustments at the grocery store, where costs are up 13% from last year.
And we are big grillers, so the meat market is one of our favorite places to be. Having watched some of those prices of things as simple as chicken breast just skyrocket, those were kind of go-to, safe, easy, inexpensive things.
Henning considers herself a Republican, but sometimes votes for Democrats. She hasn't decided who she'll vote for governor or U.S. senator yet, but she says the economy is her number one issue. And she's not alone. Milwaukee resident Amon Sayavong, an independent voter who often votes for Democrats, says he thinks the economy is the most important issue because it affects everyone.
Even though people will say, you know, people will talk about abortion or crime, I think you are not affected by that on a daily basis. But when you have to go and pay, you know, 10-20% more for your gas, that's something that affects you directly.
Inflation is an increase in prices that happens when demand exceeds supply. It's happening at high levels in the U.S. and around the world, thanks mostly to disruptions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine, according to economists. In the latest Marquette University Law School poll released Wednesday, 68% of respondents said they were very concerned about inflation, the most of any issue. And so the candidates for statewide office are talking about it, like in the race for U.S. Senate between Republican Senator Ron Johnson.
Inflation is the Democrats' tax on the middle class.
And Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes.
Most senators couldn't tell you the cost of a gallon of milk.
And in the race for governor between Democratic Governor Tony Evers.
Folks, that's a problem. That's why I have a plan to cap prescription drug prices.
And Republican Tim Michaels.
Tim Michaels, I've got a blueprint to grow jobs and stop the outrageous spending that got us into this mess.
But according to University of Michigan labor economist Don Grimes, there are only so many ways to address inflation. One is to reduce demand. In other words, make people want to buy less. You can do that, Grimes says, by raising taxes. But in an election year, politicians don't want to talk about that.
And I wouldn't hold my breath after the election either.
The other way, which has already happened a few times this year, is through an interest rate hike from the nation's powerful central bank, the Federal Reserve. Grimes says that should slow inflation, but will likely cause other economic consequences.
I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that the Federal Reserve will bring down inflation. The problem is that they sort of have a blunt tool to do that, where they increase interest rates, and that it tends to cause a recession frequently.
Regardless of what actually happens with the economy in the coming months, Grimes expects it will influence voters. He says historically, when people perceive the economy as bad, they punish the party in power. And that's why he thinks this will be a Republican year.
You know, politicians get too much credit when things are going well, and they get too much blame when things are going bad. But, that's the job they took.
But Grimes says there's a disconnect between what voters feel about the economy and what politicians can actually change. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to studying microorganisms in the untreated wastewater of sewer systems. This work has become much more high profile in COVID times. What researchers have called public health wastewater surveillance, tracking how much COVID-19 genetic material is circulating in a given community. And there's really big international cooperation on this. Ready for this? The COVID Poops 19 Global Wastewater Dashboard. Nearly 4,000 monitoring sites, hundreds of universities involved, including UW-Milwaukee. Join in on the sewer microbiome, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan Newton is an assistant professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Ryan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Good morning. Sandra McClellan here as well, professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Sandra, welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having us this morning.
Yes. Well, it feels like studying microbes in sewer samples has made really great strides in the pandemic, or it seems the scientific community has become very cooperative on this. Why study microbes in sewers?
You know, this is something that our group, between Ryan and I, have actually worked on for about 10 years. And we started the research by just asking the question, how can we track sewage pollution in the environment? When the pandemic happened, it really gave us kind of a jump start on understanding how we can also track some of these pathogens that are coming from people and understand kind of the health of the community.
Ryan, walk us through how you do this wastewater surveillance to detect this bacteria and maybe even detect infectious diseases. How does it work?
Sure. So first you have to have a sample. So typically the wastewater treatment facility has people there that will be taking a sample. The samples we get, they collect over a 24-hour period. So it gives you an integrated look at everything that's coming down sort of the sewer pipes over that period of time. You then extract the nucleic acids. In this case, it's RNA. So these viruses are RNA-based viruses. So you extract that out of all the microbes that are coming down in those water samples. And then you're targeting specific genes that are present only in those viruses, in this case, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and quantifying how much is there. So you can quantify that using a technique that amplifies and detects that particular region that are on these viruses. And you can ask the question, you know, how much of it is there and how does that change over time as you get samples on a sort of daily or weekly basis?
You start getting a much more complete picture, I imagine, Sandra. And you looked at the microbiomes in the sewer pipes of a dozen of cities around the nation, found human fecal bacteria is around 13% of a city's sewer microbiome. Sandra, what other things reside in city sewers?
You know, there's a whole lot of bacteria that are simply growing in the pipes. And that actually surprised us because when we did start this work, we were looking kind of for the human bacteria, the ones that people carry. And what we found, like you said, only 13% of the bacteria were from people. The organisms that live in the pipe are the ones that are growing almost like a culture. And when you think about how expansive our cities are, it's almost 10,000 miles of pipe. There's a huge biomass of organisms there. And a big focus of our research is understanding, are they helping, you know, break down waste? Are they good for the city? Or are they harming our infrastructure? Are they causing some negative effects like deteriorating pipes?
What did you find, as you looked across cities?
you know, it was really surprising to see all the cities were really uniform. And that tells us that city infrastructure pipes are kind of the same environment everywhere. So pipes in Hawaii and Australia and New York and Milwaukee grow the same kind of bacteria. That's really important because it gives us a big opportunity then to change that environment just a little bit to select for the good guys and try and keep out the bad guys. And that's work that's kind of underway. We're just at the very beginning of trying to understand how to tweak those conditions to keep the good guys there. And those are the ones that will break down waste before it gets to the treatment plant.
There's also this urgency around antimicrobial resistance. And, you know, the CDC has been looking at this in a report where they said that the threat of antimicrobial resistant infections is not only still present, but it's getting worse. You know, Ryan, what is the role of wastewater surveillance in helping to address that issue?
Yeah, I think this is really, you know, sort of the benefit of, you know, the big effort that went in to wastewater monitoring, you know, during the pandemic here, is this sort of byproduct of there are other avenues by which we can look at human health or things that are related to human health in these systems. One of those, as you just said, was antibiotic resistance. And so I don't know that everyone knows exactly yet, you know, how this is all going to play out and what the true benefits will be. But it, certainly on paper, we can monitor for antibiotic resistance of things that are of concern. So resistances that are in organisms, in pathogens that we're concerned about in hospitals. So those can be monitored in a coordinated network across the country so that you can identify when those sort of organisms are increasing in the community, and maybe we should be more concerned about them. Also, there's a possibility to monitor for things that might be developing, you know, into the future. Can we see new things that are new organisms, new resistances that might be trouble for us in the future?
So really getting some established data, some of this baseline data can help you understand when that, you know, things change. And I wonder, Sandra, what can researchers do with that more comprehensive knowledge of the, you know, antibiotic resistant organisms that are residing in city sewers?
You know, it's really important to match it up with what is going on in the kind of the public health setting. And I think that's really where wastewater surveillance has kind of jumped ahead and formed these partnerships. So our group works really closely with the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene. And by establishing a baseline of what's in these kind of sewer systems, we can then start to talk with the clinical side. What are they seeing in hospitals? What are they seeing, you know, in doctors' offices? And start to match up, as you know, as Ryan pointed out, what new threats might we have in the community, and get, you know, really kind of this head start on, hey, maybe there should be more outreach on we're using antibiotics too much, or a heads up that doctors should watch for certain antibiotic resistant infections. I think there's been, you know, the real partnership has really allowed us to then be able to act on this data, as opposed to, you know, just publish a paper and say, this is interesting, we see this in the sewer systems. I think it really boils down to coming up with actionable data that public health can use as a tool.
One of those tools, I think, is this national effort, the National Wastewater Surveillance System. What impact and capacity does that have?
You know, it covers almost all of the United States. I want to say there's 47 states participating now. So not only do we get really practical boots on the ground information in Wisconsin, we can compare Wisconsin to what's happening around the country. And there's these really great collaborative networks that, you know, they call them kind of communities of practice, where the people that do what I do in the state talk with the other states, both on the science side and the public health side. And it's this, they call it NEWS, the National Wastewater Surveillance System. That has developed so quickly in the last 2.5 years, but it has brought together everybody where they're kind of sharing information back and forth. And I think that has really kind of had this huge benefit of, you know, I don't have to figure everything out. What's going on in Utah or New York or California, I can use that knowledge in my own state and in my own lab to kind of advance the science.
Sandra McClellan with us and Ryan Newton, our faculty in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, studying sewer samples to find what bacteria are present in various cities, places. Join in on wastewater surveillance research, what you want to know about it, your curiosities, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Since the early days of the pandemic, researchers have taken samples of wastewater across the state to look for the virus that causes COVID-19. And this statewide wastewater monitoring program is really data rich on the state health department site, with the SARS-CoV-2 in wastewater trending up over the past month. As I look at the line in the participating sewer shed, as it's called, join in, 800-642-1234. We have Sandra McClellan and Ryan Newton. They are faculty in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and stay with us. Ryan, what role could wastewater have in monitoring community health as you look ahead with the next big virus after COVID-19?
Yeah, I think we're in a much better position than we would have been or we were before, in that the wastewater can be used almost immediately, or this could be ramped up almost immediately, to understand levels that are circulating in the community. So before, widespread testing is done for individuals, you would be able to get this sort of early warning or early indication of how widespread any virus might be spreading through the community, as long as it's shed, into the wastewater system.
Sandra, is COVID still detectable in wastewater as you look at that data?
Unfortunately, it is. And we see, we see persistent levels. So that tells us it's percolating at low levels through the community. One of the things that we've really been able to get a jump on, though, is tracking the different variants. So people have heard about that in the news. The virus is always evolving and changing. And as it changes, then it can kind of get past our immune system. So if you've been immunized or maybe you've had COVID, 6 months or a year down the road, there's a new strain that your immune system hasn't seen. So not only are we watching the SARS-CoV-2 levels to see how it's going up or down in the community, we're also testing for very specific variants. And that has been great for early warning, because you hear about these variants maybe in Europe or on the East Coast, and we can ask the question, are they already here in Wisconsin?
And are you using samples from a lot of different sewer systems in Wisconsin, or how does that work? How do you choose what to sample?
Oh, that's a great question. How do we choose? We started with 72 wastewater treatment plants, and we've kind of scaled it back to 40 in the state. And when I say we, I mean our whole statewide program. The real heavy lifting is done out at the state lab of hygiene, and they cover a good portion of the state. And then our lab also cooperates on doing kind of the Southeast Wisconsin part of the state. And I think the choice of wastewater treatment plants has been really strategic to make sure we cover rural areas as well as kind of the heavily urbanized areas. The goal is to be, efficient, where we're doing, kind of good coverage for sampling, but we don't use too many resources. We kind of keep resources in reserve. So if we have to ramp up or test for something else, we have the capacity to do that.
We're exploring the microbiomes beneath us, more than 70 major cities and sewer systems, what they tell us, especially in COVID times. UW-Milwaukee researchers Sandra McClellan and Ryan Newton with us. You can join in on wastewater surveillance, what you want to know about it, 800-642-1234. I was reading new survey results on the public's perception of wastewater surveillance. It came out this week in The Conversation, and the respondents overwhelmingly said, you know, 92% want surveillance for things like Ebola and tuberculosis, for COVID and environmental toxins. But their enthusiasm was way less in favor of monitoring for lifestyle behaviors, like monitoring wastewater for smoking or birth control or healthy eating. What do you think, Sandra, of wastewater surveillance and tracking external threats like diseases versus tracking these very personal lifestyle aspects?
You know, that's really understandable that I think that it comes into, you know, how people feel about privacy and their ability to maybe not be judged by their lifestyle. And it is a very large ethical question that we're just starting to tackle. I think 2 years ago, this wasn't on the radar screen of how do we ethically handle these samples. So we're not like stigmatizing communities or identifying people personally. That just, it wasn't even a question on the table. And now all of those questions are being discussed. The good thing is we kind of have a model to follow. We do public health research in communities, and there are good guidelines for ethics to say, how should we handle that data so the people within those communities aren't harmed by it? I anticipate this is going to be an ongoing discussion, and I think the scholars that really study ethics and some of the legal implications are really stepping up and getting involved in tackling those tough questions.
Ryan, what crosses your mind as there are no health privacy protection laws or regulations about sewage surveillance in our country, and in what this area with such a trove of data points is like? How do you think about that?
Yeah, similar to what Sandra said, I think it's something we're dealing with as a community and coming up with the right sort of guidelines. There are you know, definite questions, because you can sample the sewer shed often like we do at the end of all the pipes, where you're getting an integrated signal of the whole city. But you can also go way up into the sewer shed and sample, you know, a neighborhood or so on. And so there's certainly ethical questions of like, how far up into the system is too far for some of these measurements. And then, of course, as Sandra said, the privacy issues are certainly an excellent question. And, what level are these data? Should these data be made available to researchers so they understand what's going on in public health, versus giving people their privacy so that the results don't harm them in any way? And I that'll be an ongoing question, and certainly something in the community that's talked about constantly.
Well, Ryan and Sandra, thank you both for joining us and sharing your research.
Thanks for having us this morning.
Yes, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Sandra McClellan and Ryan Newton are in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. We have a link to their research, Guts of the Urban Ecosystem, at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.